Today's guest says that the truth can be a difficult muse to court, but ultimately the truth frees us from mistaken assumptions about who we are and who we are not. Hello, everyone. My name is Pamela Brewer, and I'm very pleased to introduce to you Linda Joy Myers, who is the author of Song of the Plains, a memoir of family secrets and silence. And she is here today on this edition of Women's Wednesday here at Mind Talk. Linda Joy Myers, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm so pleased to be here and talking with you today. Thank you.
Now, Linda, you are the president of the National Association of Memoir Writers. You're a therapist, a workshop leader. You're busy enough just with your practice. Why write a memoir?
Why write a second memoir also?
That's a good question.
Well, the thing about memoir is that some of us, myself and then a lot of the people that I coach and teach, have stories, have family stories, have parts of our lives that just won't leave us alone. We have maybe questions to ask ourselves and, you know, answers that we're trying to get. And so when it comes to my memoirs, my first book, Don't Call Me Mother, I couldn't not write it. I tried very hard not to write it, but it was as if it kept chasing me and it wouldn't leave me alone until I finally said, okay, I actually shouted at this little voice that comes in my head, that came in my head, saying, you know, you need to write this. There's some things here that can help other people, and about mothers and daughters and legacies. So I said, okay, fine. If I write it, will you leave me alone? So I did, and it was really satisfying to finish that book. It was from the point of view of a child, a coming-of-age story, trying to understand three generations of mothers who abandoned their daughters and what happened. So people who read Song of the Plains are going to see some of the same people, and the story is the same story, but I am exploring this what happened question from the point of view of an adult who, again, I guess I have an obsessive disorder of some kind, because I was completely obsessed with finding out what happened to my mother as a little girl. Where did she live? Who was she? What was she doing? And my grandmother, to try to more deeply, all these years later, understand them, and ended up doing a lot of research, which we can talk about later. So I wasn't going to write this book, but it didn't haunt me quite as much as the first one. But there were just themes and questions that I just kept holding in my mind, and I decided to write to explore those themes and questions and see what happened.
Well, you know, Linda, we're at a time in our lives which, and this is not an unusual thing to hear, just sort of broadly in society, but certainly nowadays many people say, you know, it's the past, let it go, move on, blah, blah, blah. You have chosen to delve into 40 years of research into your own family. So I guess I need you to really kind of go into more detail about why that was so important for you and why you believe that's important in general.
I understand. So just to give a little background, I grew up with my grandmother, who raised me after my mother left when I was four, and I soon knew as a young child also that I never knew how old my mother was. I only knew a little bit about where she lived and so on, and so I grew up in this cauldron, this triangle of these two women didn't get along. They had these big dish-throwing, screaming fights. My mother would run off and leave in the middle of the night. I mean, it was crazy. And worse, it just kept happening year after year after year. And so as a child, I was just this kind of person who wanted to understand, why do these people act like this and what is happening? There had to be some way of understanding it, is what I believed. And that was long before I became a therapist or knew anything about psychology. But I was gifted to know my great-grandmother, Blanche, who was my grandmother's mother. And she began to tell me the story about my mother and grandmother, at least a little bit of it, and infused with emotion. Like she'd say, it's a darn shame those two can't get along. And she would look really sad. So I knew that I wasn't the only one who thought it was sad that they didn't get along. Mm-hmm. And then she let me know, I was 8 and she was 80 when we were having this first conversation. And she mentioned my mother as a little girl. She says, well, little Jotine, you know, I just knew she was so cute. She was so beautiful. And at 8, I was shocked. I said, you knew my mother? You know, and so I found out that someone 80 years old knew a lot about the history that I didn't know anything about. And frankly, that discussion in the garden, there were many more stories that she told me in a feather bed at night when we were sleeping next to each other. She told me this story about her life in the 19th century, the being a midwife, being a farmer's wife who took care of 9 children, made bread in the summer and a wood cook stove, all kinds of details about their life. And this is what started it all. This is what I tell everyone started me totally getting involved more deeply, is I looked down at Blanche and I realized she was a walking storybook. And I was like, oh my gosh, so if I just can talk to all these grown-ups, I realized that every grown-up walking around was a walking storybook also. If I can just talk to them and get them to talk to me, then I can understand. I can find out more. I can understand about my mother and grandmother and what happened and why. And there were many layers to the story that I, you know, I can't go into all of it right now. But that was what hooked me. And so there was a deep emotional need to find out more about my mother and grandmother. And then I didn't know much about my father either, although that search didn't come till much later in my life. But who were these people? And worse, I mean, the pattern that was going on is that my grandmother rejected my mother. My mother rejected me not only by leaving, but later the title of Don't Call Me Mother comes into play. She literally told me not to call her mother anymore. She didn't want anybody in Chicago to know that she had a daughter. Well, this was not acceptable to me. I mean, this sort of blackout, this not being able, why did she do that? I don't know. So as a psychologist, as a therapist, you know, part of what we do is try to help people put together their own stories to understand their own families, to understand how their past affects their present, because it often does, whether we know it or not. So I use the same techniques for myself, and I asked a lot of questions over the years. I can get deeper into the research that I did when you're ready for that, but I couldn't leave it alone because it's a part of my story, and I didn't understand it. And you give me something I don't understand, man, and I will move heaven and earth to try to find out about that story. And that's part of what led to the 40 years. Is just I had to know more.
Well, I'm curious. You began your search. You were motivated to begin a search. Just sounds like internally. Mm-hmm. And grandmother was really helpful. And then what did you do when you actually began to prepare this book? What did you do?
I mean, actually what happened, I did some, what you call it, original sources research in the 70s, 80s, and 90s in particular. And in the mid-90s, based on a lot of what I found, I ended up being gifted, I say it that way on purpose, with a voice that came to me somewhere in the mid-90s. that gave me this overview of our family history. I had done enough research then. It wasn't through Ancestry.com or anything. It was going to dusty courthouses and combing through microfilms and going to graveyards and finding the names and the dates and taking notes and all this. I heard kind of a voice telling me this larger story about my family and America. It's a story really about American pioneers. And I want to add, it's more of a story about American pioneers than I even knew when I did the research or even when I wrote the book. Just yesterday, I got my DNA Ancestry.com results. And, wow, it was truly a pioneer story, and I didn't know it directly, but it's been confirmed through the DNA testing where exactly people were and where they came from, and I was sort of jumping up and down. So I guess I'm a pretty good researcher because I just intuited that there had to be a bigger story than me, you know, and my family. And in any book, anyone who reads any kind of book, they want to know, well, this is great that this happened to this person, but is there something here for me to think about myself? And I wanted to make sure that this current book was enabling people to take my story and begin to wonder about theirs. So as I put the book together, I found this material that was lying around in my computer that I wrote in the 90s, over 20 years ago, and I realized that it contained an essence of my story that I hadn't thought about in that way for a long time. Turns out unconsciously, I think I've sort of been gathering the material to write this book for many years, and then finally it was one of those moments where something bloomed, you know, and I realized the true nature of what this book needed to be. So it was quite a somewhat semi-conscious, unconscious, and then conscious process.
You know, it's interesting to hear you talk about graveyards and old dusty library. I mean, certainly those days, I think, sadly, people may not do that kind of research as much nowadays since there is so much available via online options. Let me ask you this. You do say early on in the book that you describe you and your mother as both being abandoned daughters. So we know that your mom left you, sounds like emotionally, long before physically. What did you learn about your own mom?
Wow. Well, I was propelled particularly to learn about my mother, whom I felt so sorry for my mother. My mother was pretty off the wall and very emotional and also very hurtful, and all that was true. But she was still my mother, you know. I could feel, I felt that connection, and I sympathized with her in moments of the calm and the quiet, that when I could reflect back on her. And I found a lot of pictures of my mother as a little girl, and she was a very serious-looking little girl, and she lived here and there. She lived with family, but, you know, she was a lost child. And I had done a lot of therapy with lost children, literally very small lost children. I was a lost child, and so I wanted to know my mother better. There was kind of no way to know the real mother in real life that much better because she didn't allow it. But I felt that if I could walk in her shoes and see the world through her eyes, and if I could learn what happened to her, our broken connection could be healed also, which I really believed in. I still do. I believe that that's the deep healing that we can do. So what I did for, I had extended family in Iowa all these years, and so I'd go see them in Muscatine, Iowa, and then I would go to the town where my mother was born, Wapello, Iowa, and for 7 years, for 1 hour at a visit, because that's all the time I could spend in the library, maybe 2 hours at the very most, but I would go and I would comb through the microfilm of the newspaper that was owned by my mother's grandfather in those years. It didn't matter that he owned it, but it just so happened that he did. And I looked for our family name, and there's a social column in these old newspapers. And the social column tells you who's visiting whom, what they're wearing, how they got there, how long they stayed, and their name, everybody's names. And so I found our family names over and over and over again. So it took 7 years to get all the way from 1914, the year before my mother was born, but my grandmother had a stillborn child that year. It's in the newspaper. And then my mother is born, and so who they visited, where they lived, the news about the family, I tracked it all the way to 1919 or 1920, and then lost track, and I figured that that's when my grandmother must have left the town. I didn't know what happened. Actually, I didn't know what happened until a couple of years ago.
But, you know, that's fascinating just to imagine you going through those old documents and reading about your family, people you yep. had never met. It just, what did that feel like?
Well, I had actually, this Iowa family, this extended Iowa family, I had met all of these people, but they were old when I met them. So in the newspaper, they're kids. These are children. This is my great-grandmother when she was in her 20s and 30s, not 80 years old. This is my great-aunts and uncles that were my grandmother's. They were her half-brothers and sisters because her own father died before she was born, which is another part of our story. So I was like, oh, yay, she had a child. This is my mother. She had a little childhood. They would say things like the sweet little girl, Josephine, you know. I'm like, oh, you know, like it made her real. She actually had a history that was noted somewhere. It helped me, you know, because there was so much fragmentation in our story. There were so many holes in our story. I felt like I was made of about a million pieces that still needed to be knitted together.
That sounds like a painful feeling.
Yeah, it was hard, but, you know, I was like, I had this vision, and I think part of it's intuitive, part of it's spiritual, part of it is psychological, that if I just tried hard enough that I could find them. I could find my grandmother. I did the same thing for my grandmother. I found her in her youth. I found out what she was doing, where she was living. She also had eloped when she was young. And I put all these stories in there, as you know. And if you want to understand, if you want to have a story that holds together, you have to create a narrative. And in the narrative, this happens, and then this leads to that, and this leads to this, and this leads to this, right? And if you have big holes in the what leads to what, you don't have a narrative. You don't have a story. You have a fragment of a story, but you don't have the story.
Right.
So this book, I didn't ever plan to write a book about all this stuff, at least very consciously, but you know, I thought back, I looked back at some of my notes. You know, you forget sort of what you've gathered. And I looked in my closet, and there were all these books on the Great Plains. I was doing the history of the Great Plains, too. You know, I was curious, okay, well, if this is my history, what's the history of the land?
Interesting.
And I grew up in Oklahoma, but our relatives were all in Iowa. All of it's part of the Plains. Oklahoma has its own very strong Native American history, and we're taught that in school. I mean, we're very immersed in Oklahoma history, actually. So I started researching the archaeological and paleontology of the Great Plains, and I started to connect, you know, the migration of the pioneers with the many eons of history in the land. And these things, for whatever reason, they just fascinate me, you know? So I'm having fun with my obsession. I mean, it doesn't hurt anybody.
And it actually may help more than a few people. Linda, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we will continue to talk about your work and what you discovered as you researched your family history. We'll be right back. You had so many disruptions in your life. Can you describe what it felt like the day that you learned you were going to leave your grandmother to live with cousins who actually didn't treat you very well?
Yeah. Oh, yes. I remember it. You know, they say that traumatic memory makes a very deep groove in your brain. I mean, some people repress it and forget it. I don't know why I didn't. I always remembered this time. Well, the situation was my mother had left me with my grandmother and we were doing fine. But the story was, I don't know what really happened actually, but the story was that my parents wanted me to live with a family that had children. And we did have my grandmother's first cousin and his wife and children lived nearby. And somehow this was all cooked up. But I do remember when my grandmother told me about this idea, A, she looked extremely distressed, and B, in my belly, I knew it was all wrong. It was like, no. And I said, no, please don't send me. I thought I had done something wrong. I said, I'll eat my prunes. I'll go to bed on time, you know. I begged her, which, of course, distressed her even more, I'm sure. But, you know, I just knew it was really wrong for me to be there. I had met these people. I met these children. I did not like them. I did not trust these people. There was something off with them. And it turns out I was absolutely correct. And I was 4 years old when I was feeling that. Mm. So I guess it must have been five by then. So then she packed my suitcase, washed my clothes, cried the whole time. She did not want to do this either, but she did not have custody of me. I don't know if she could have fought that, whatever. I mean, I think there'd already been so much infighting that maybe she thought she could give it a try. And she seemed to get along with these people okay, and it was her cousin. The man was her cousin, not the woman. So they came. And it was like going off into, I'll never forget it. You know, I got in the back of this Ford car, and there were these older boys and this younger girl, and we were all stuffed in the back seat. And I remember they drove away, and they saw a cloud, and they said, oh, do you think that's a tornado? And I didn't know what that was, really. But it was just a dread, and things the next day got even worse.
How so?
Well, this woman, the mother, decided she was going to be very strict with me. I think they thought I was getting some kind of too much coddling with my grandmother. I don't think that's true, but that seemed to be the attitude they had, and later on I think that was affirmed. But so the mother got me out on the front porch, and she let me know that I was supposed to call her mother. And, I mean, I knew who my mother was, and it certainly was not this lady.
Yeah, that's jarring.
And, oh, my God, I was like, no. I mean, I didn't say no, but I just stood there And I locked my knees, and we stood, and I stood. She sat in a rocking chair and rocked. I stood and stood and stood. And she said, "We're going to stay here until you do it." And, okay, you know, I was up for that. It got dark, finally. I mean, it wasn't dark when we came out there. And lots of time went on. And I don't know, it could have been a whole hour, which sounds like forever to a five-year-old. And it got dark, and I knew that we would stay there until I did it. So I apologized to my mother in my head, and I said it, you know. But it was hard won on her part, and it was just a clue as to what was about to come, you know.
One of the things you talk about is being punished for being sick.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know what was wrong with this lady, but, you know, she had weird ideas, and there was some level, psychologically, I can stand back and say, there was some level of, I believe, to be fair, or somewhat fair, jealousy about who my grandmother was. This is a woman, the family must have known it. I only knew some of the story when I was little, who had gone to Europe. She had married up. She had left the Iowa clan, and for better or worse, around what happened to my mother, she created a life that was not possible for many, many, many women of that era. And, you know, a lot of families and people don't like to see somebody marry up and do any better and have a little money and be able to buy a car. You know, they don't like that. I don't know if that's what was up, but, I mean, they picked on me as if I was some kind of spoiled thing. And I was just a scared little five-year-old. I didn't know anything about anything. I was just hanging out. I was a very compliant child. I mean, you tell me to do something, I'd usually do it. So I think there was a bigger issue there that was being played out. I don't know, though.
And clearly, your stay there was just not safe.
No, there was molestation, there was lots of spankings that made no sense. She also whipped her own children. She didn't just do it to me, but she sure did a lot of that. And there was a wicked little grin that would come on her face when she caught at least me doing something. And it was pretty rough. The sad part was that my mother came to visit, and I, at five, assessed my mother as to whether she'd take me away and save me if I told her what was happening. And I watched her interact with the woman and the family, and I realized that my mother would not take me away. I'm sure I was correct about that. She wouldn't have done it. She had her own life she wanted to live. My father came to visit. By then I was sort of in worse shape. There's actually a picture of me that shows exactly how I felt. And I realized he would not take me away. He had just gotten remarried. He didn't want to bother with a child. So I didn't tell them. And it was just a happy accident that I'd gotten sick as the family was going on a vacation. And they dropped me at my grandmother's house. And she took one look at me. I don't think she'd seen me, or maybe she'd only seen me once that whole year. And she flipped out. She realized something was terribly wrong because I wouldn't talk. And I'm a talkative person, as you can see now. I was talkative when I was five, but I was not talkative after I came back. There were too many things I couldn't say that were stuck inside of me. So there was this moment that changed our lives where she begged me. She realized something was terribly wrong, and mm-hmm. She, on her hands and on her knees in front of me, crying, begged me to tell her what happened there. And I didn't tell her everything, but I told her some of it. And she got on the phone and screamed at my parents and said, "Well, fine, then I'm taking her." I guess they were like making excuses or something. I don't know what they said. And then the family came back to get me. And I didn't trust anyone by then. And so she said she wouldn't let me go with them, but I wasn't sure about anybody. I believed her, sort of, you know. So they came, and she told them. I hid, and anyway, she kept me, you know, and we went on from there.
So what a relief that was for you at that time to be rescued from that painful, mm-hmm. abusive household.
It was very good, and for several years we moved then to Oklahoma where her best friend lived, and we had some good years, but gradually things began to deteriorate. I don't know what happened psychologically with her, but she never let me forget that I was a guest in her home and that I had no home.
Huh.
That this was, I was lucky that she saved me, and I'd better darn well do what she says right now, or out comes the yardstick or the slap on the face. That's what it deteriorated to in high school. But before that, there were many wonderful good times, which I also put in both books. And my grandmother was an amazing person who I think had her own psychological issues. And having not had any therapy or anything, I think they eventually, I can look back now and say, I think they got to her. They got to both my mother and my grandmother. That was part of why I wanted to write, explore before I knew I was writing this book. Who were they when they were young?
Mm-hmm.
Who were they trying to be? Because they certainly didn't plan to be these broken down, miserable people they ended up later in their life. And the bigger thing is, what do I need to do to not be like them?
Exactly. At some point, you learned about why your grandmother was opposed to your dating boys. Now, in the scheme of things, I don't know of any parent who isn't opposed to their child dating.
Yeah.
What made this stand out for you? There came a time when you realized that why your grandmother did not want you to date boys. Again, mm-hmm. in the scheme of things, you know, most parents don't want their children to date anybody until they're 106. So why was your grandmother's concern particularly meaningful for you?
Well, it was complicated in that she also had a very contentious relationship with my father. And there was this sort of anti-man, anti-father thing going on that I'd heard and knew of through the years. So I didn't think that that was a very balanced way to view the world, even then, before being a therapist officially and all that. So I didn't agree with that, and I was lucky. There were some men that weren't so great in my life that they're in the books, but I was lucky to have some wonderful male teachers. My grandmother's friend, whom we called Uncle Mage, was a wonderful father figure to me, and so I had a positive attitude about men in spite of what had happened, men and boys. I was also blessed to be a musician, thanks to my grandmother, and I knew many very sweet and kind young men, and they were very respectful. They were raised well. It was they knew the rules. They were they would never do anything to hurt any of their friends, girlfriends or girls that they knew. So the boy that I fell in love with was 3 years older than me. We'd been in the cello section for years and years and years. And eventually when I was 17 and he was 20, this bloomed into something else. And I thought since she'd known him all this time that she would, think that was fine. Well, she didn't, and there's a story there. But what I realized as I wrote these books is that it was connected to something that happened to her, and that is that she suffered from, I think, later, and that is she eloped when she was 17 years old, and this was confirmed through my Ancestry.com research. She eloped to marry my grandfather. Now, that was the first instance of her moving up. She went from a lower class, working class, pretty poor background to marrying a middle class boy. And he's the son of the guy who owned the newspaper in this town. Okay, so then that broke down, and later on she remarried again a man who was older than her and had money. And I don't know much about him. She didn't talk about him that much because he had already died when she was raising me. But he was upper middle class. And so, however, in my research and in my work as a psychologist, when someone eloped in 1911, everyone assumed it was a very shameful thing to do. It would shame and humiliate the family. The families, I'm sure, gave them a very hard time about this. I think that it's very possible, and this is what I imagine when I start writing from my grandmother's point of view, that she showed up in this middle-class household and appeared uneducated. I mean, she had education, but, you know, how people act in some families is very different than the manners and the protocol in a middle-class family. And I think she probably suffered a lot from that. So she made sure I was never, ever going to date somebody who wasn't at least middle class, or she wanted me to actually try for upper middle, which was ridiculous in our town. It was a silly idea because they didn't exist, really. But she always had this idea about, you know, going above your station. And so it was all very complicated, her own elopement, her prejudice and ideas about class, and just her desire to control me. I mean, let's face it, that was part of it. And it didn't matter that this young man was somebody we had known for years and years. There was a lot of projection going on, I know now. So, but in this book, I tried to go behind all the injuries and all the, you know, the brokenheartedness of some of this to explore what was it that drove her in that way to, you know, in ways that then showed up in my life. Furthermore, one more point is that my mother eloped too when she was 17, by the way.
Ah, interesting.
So my grandmother, I'm sure she did say, I want you running off and getting married. And I was like, what? I mean, it was the farthest thing from my mind. But if you're projecting, you're going to project your own story onto somebody.
Exactly.
You know, and so I think she thought I would. I don't know what she thought exactly. It was just really a tough situation.
So if she kept you from boys, you wouldn't elope?
Well, it doesn't make any sense, does it?
not a bunch, but, you know, she was trying to protect you in her own way. She also was very adamant for a while that you have nothing to do with your dad, and you really fought back and wanted to spend time with your dad. How did that turn out?
Oh, man. You ask all these pithy questions. Well, I wanted to know more about my father. I missed my father. I more missed a father. It took me most of my life to realize that I was interacting with more or less a phantom or fantasy father in my mind. And at first it was, we did see each other and he'd come and visit, but just like with my mother, they'd have these knockdown, drag out, screaming fights, and it would be very tense. And some years he didn't come. I can't quite blame him. They had fights through letters. People didn't use a phone so much in those days, you know, but through letters and through the visits. But finally, she, after several years, allowed me to see him again. And unfortunately, there was a scene of molestation with him. Luckily, it wasn't as bad as it could be, but it really broke trust, and I did begin to wonder if anybody had any sense in my family. I mean, you know, like, what is wrong with everybody?
Well, stability and safety was not a part of the family tradition.
Yeah, right. You know, and so it was very heartbreaking to see these things happening, and it was very confusing. And what the context now in which people are molested or hear about incest, I mean, these words are actually used now. And there were no words for these things then. I mean, I had no words. I didn't know this was something that happened, you know, with people. I didn't know. It had no name. It had no words. Right. And in that situation, it's just all chaos in your head, you know, and in your heart. You just know something's terribly wrong, and you can't even figure out what to do about it or what to say or anything. So I did break with my father for a while, but I don't know. I'm one of these people, I really believe in forgiveness. I really believe in trying again to understand what's going on. And so I eventually reached out to my father, and he was so grateful. I mean, he never misbehaved after that.
Well, that is a good thing. Linda, we're going to take a break, give you an opportunity to take a breath. And when we come back, we will continue with Song of the Plains, a memoir of family, secrets, and silence. We'll be right back, folks. Linda, as I look back over the lives and the lives that you've been able to uncover and explore, there were many lessons that you learned, which were really quite painful. I mean, you learned in large measure that stability was not a thing, not a real thing. Mm-hmm. You learned that men were not to be trusted, and certainly your grandmother taught you that, you know, you don't you mistrust men and you use men and you hate men, but that's kind of it. You were also taught that you were a bother. As you think back on these lessons, and I know every piece of your childhood was not horrific, but as you think back on these things that you were taught that were so painful, what do you think allowed you to survive such painful, untrue lessons to become the person you are today?
I think there were several parts to it. Part of it is I didn't believe in hate. I saw it a lot, you know. I didn't believe in people holding grudges. Look at the results. My mother and grandmother, my grandmother died. They had not worked anything out. You know, I believed that there was somehow a better way to live. And I was right about that. It's just that, you know, it took a long time to, you have to feel it from within. And you know, I just knew that it had to be there. I was also a very optimistic person. I mean, I was always thinking, well, how can this get better, you know? Good training for a therapist and a memoirist. I was also blessed, truly blessed, to have supportive people who believed in me, particularly teachers. My music teachers and teachers at school, you know, were very supportive of me. So I began to realize I had a brain and that I had a little talent as a musician, and these things held me up a lot. And I also saw that knowledge, that my grandmother, actually, this was a good part, you know, she was very much into learning and history and knowledge and literature. And so literature is another thing that helped me survive. Truly. And the last thing I want to mention is that the Song of the Plains theme is truly about the plains and what I would do when I was sad and upset. As I would go outside, maybe not for very long. My grandmother kind of kept track of me. But though, when I got older and I was more independent, also I'd drive to the outside of town and walk among the wheat fields. And when I was younger, I would look at the moon, or I would stand in the wind, or I would, you know, kind of interact with a storm that was coming. And I would be released from the pain for a little while through nature, through beauty. And I now know that there are other people who do that and other people who know that truth. But I found it rather accidentally through just noticing that nature and the wind and the beauty would comfort me. And so I would try to find that, you know, wherever I could.
That really speaks to your own belonging to nobody but you, piece of resilience and openness, because as you know, so many people with the experiences that you and I have been talking about, they learn to shut down and often stay shut down. Certainly there are times when they don't, but you know, the ability, even as a child and as a young adult, to recognize that thing, there was a better to be had and there must be a way to get to it, is really pretty extraordinary.
Well, it was a blessing. I don't know. You know, I just, maybe it's another, could call it a spiritual support that I didn't, you know, I was given, you know, I don't know. I just had a certain way to think about things and feel about things. And it took many, many years. I mean, you want to talk about the arc of healing. You know, I started therapy when I was 32, and I do write in the book about the things that led to what really was kind of like a breakdown of my old world, my old life, and when I started therapy, what I began to learn, and then what I did with that, which was to, you know, become a therapist and realize that I could use the pain that I'd gone through as a way to be with other people in their pain and to help them. And the same with memoir writing, you know, to be able to be a witness to other people. And so that gave me even greater meaning. And also I had some rocky marriages there, but doing a little repetition there for a while before I woke up, but I have three children. And so, you know, part of how you learn to heal the mother wound is to mother people and plants and pets and clients and stuff yourself. And it offers meaning and connection. So, you know, I just think we, if people can keep up the hope that as they work through and write and use art, part of my story is about using different arts to help me heal, including painting and ways of using imagery to break through some of those walls, because we can, and many of us can see ourselves in a different place, but we don't quite know how to get there, you know. And so there's these various creative healing and expressive ways that can help.
Well, let's talk a bit about your memoir writing. You describe it as writing to heal. So talk for a bit about the way that you came to memoir writing and what it has meant for you during your life.
Well, I came through it somewhat accidentally by doing journal writing, and I learned about the I did read and write some poetry, and I learned about the National Association of Poetry Therapy and went to some of their conferences and went, oh yeah, weaving words together, that's good. That fits, you know, like there's other people of like mind that I could know. And kept thinking that I kept looking for a story that could help me, you know, like, isn't there something out there about mothers and grandmothers and daughters and broken connections or abandonment or something? And there wasn't anything that I could find through all those years. There's more about that now, but it's very recent. So I thought, well, maybe I can write the story, but I started it as a novel, you know, just because memoir didn't really exist as a genre that everybody was using, or much of anybody, unless you were famous, back in the late 80s when I started writing this, some of this. So I started as a novel, but I was told in my MFA class at Mills that if the power of what I was writing was because the story was true, that it needed to be a memoir and not a novel. And I went, oh my gosh. So let's take off our clothes and stand in front of the world. Sure, no problem.
Exactly.
Oh God.
It's a lot you riskier. Know? Absolutely.
Yeah. So I knew in those days I had a very extremely strong inner critic. I had ingested my grandmother all the way around her criticisms. And so I couldn't even write in a journal for a while. My inner critic was so strong. I went through a phase. Then I broke out of that, and then I finally got brave enough to take a class. And I still know the woman who taught that first class. And she said she knew I had something, but of course I didn't know it. But she encouraged me. And then eventually the way I got into teaching memoir was rather accidental. I just realized I wanted to be involved in the arts after I got my MFA. Wasn't sure how. And so I went through a therapeutic exercise where they have you write down your ideal day and your what you love to do, like activities. And so one of the things I love to do is look at old photographs and, you know, reminisce. And my favorite times were when the Iowa family would get out the photos and we'd all talk about stuff. And then Blanche being a walking storybook, all that came around full circle. And I went, oh, this is what I like to do. Well, maybe I could teach a memoir group. You know, I had an MFA. I had a therapy license. I thought maybe I might be qualified. And I started with three people. And immediately it was just so amazing how the stories dropped us all down into truth and authenticity and voice and being fascinated by everybody's story, and I never looked back. I mean, that was the beginning in the late 90s, and then I had a group for 15 years, twice a week, part of that time in my office, and did conferences and taught therapists, and, you know, it gradually built up. And then in 2007, I realized I wanted to do something bigger for memoir writers, and it was just the scariest thing I've ever done in my life, but creating the organization, National Association of Memoir Writers. But I didn't know anything about the internet. I didn't know anything about business or credit cards or PayPal or anything. But I leaped in because I thought that, well, sure, there should be something for memoir writers on the web. And we're still growing and I'm still developing it. And then teaching, I'm teaching with my colleague, Brooke Warner. We teach a class called Write Your Memoir in 6 months. And we've brought through about 270 people out of that class. And I just love it. So I'm having a great time.
Is there a difference between journal writing and memoir writing?
Well, memoir writing gets you more into structure of story and learning about the narrative voice and learning about dialogue and characterization and tools that make a novel work. Although in a memoir, you're writing the truth, your truth as you remember it, the best way you can remember it, and you're using story techniques to bring the reader into those moments. Whereas when you're journaling, you don't need to do all that. You know who everybody is. You're just writing how you feel. You're just writing your reactions, all of which is important and good, but a memoir is meant to be read by someone other than yourself, ultimately.
Your life today, you said that you had three children. How are your relationships with your children?
Well, you know, relationships with children can go up and down.
Indeed.
We're all talking with each other. We're a family. There are times when one or the other children has needed some more distance, you know, and then that has to be worked out. I have to say I'm closest to my daughter because she's a girl and because she empathizes and understands and is very similar to me. And we just We both say we broke the pattern, you know, and it's true. We are friends now. We had to go through some stuff to get there, but we both kept trying, and bless her heart, she, you know, I'm sure I'm not an easy person to be. One time she said to me, "Mom, I don't think you understand how hard it is to be a daughter of yours," at which point I sat down hard in the chair and went, "Gosh, I bet that's true." Thank goodness she could say it, though. Man, I would have gotten slapped across the room if I'd ever said such a thing, you know? Yeah. So she said it, and I heard it, and I went, wow, okay, well, tell me about that, you know?
So thank goodness she could say it, and thank goodness that you could hear it.
Right.
And that
right.
you didn't try to slap her across the room.
No, God, no. And so now her children, her daughter, whose middle name is Joy, like mine, is also a writer, and she's working on a novel. So that's kind of fun.
That actually sounds very, very cool.
Yeah.
How do people get information about the National Association of Memoir Writers?
Sure, they can just Google that name, or they can go to namw.org. And find out what's going on there. And I do have an author site that talks about, I have other books on writing, The Power of Memoir and my first memoir and so on. And that's LindaJoyMyersAuthor.com. So those places have connections to other things that I mentioned, like the class and, you know, just and then I want to say on National Association of Memoir Writers, there's free events every month for people. People don't have to join in on the conversation about memoir with us.
That's wonderful. And spell the name for the LindaJoyMyers.com site.
Sure. It's LindaJoyMyers, author, AUTHOR.com.
Terrific. LindaJoyMyersAuthor.com.
Yes.
And if somebody is as they're listening to our conversation today, is really motivated to try their hand at memoir writing, but has never written a thing in their lives, is the mm-hmm. National Association of Memoir Writers a reasonable first step?
I think so. For a couple reasons. One is that they can join our free roundtable discussions, which feature people who are writing memoirs who are just ordinary people like the rest of us, who did make their dream come true, and we get to find out how they did that. There's also, if people sign up for our newsletter list, they get an ebook called, I think it's called Begin Your Memoir Now or Write Your Memoir Now, and it's how to get started from zero, just the idea of wanting to get started, and talks about how to come up with significant moments list and how to, you know, just start writing their story. Just you start by starting, basically, but yeah. It gives you a few suggestions.
That's wonderful. Linda Joy Myers, thank you so much. You have, again, written a wonderful book, Song of the Plains, a memoir of family secrets and silence. Linda Joy Myers, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, and I really enjoy this discussion with you today.
I am delighted, and I'm sure that there are listeners who will be motivated to try their hand at some writing as well. So thank you for that.
I hope so. Yeah. All right. Thank you.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to take the place of any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available to you on demand by going to myndtalk.org. You can download the Mind Talk app from the iTunes or Google Play Store. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. I would love to know where in the world you are as you're listening to Mind Talk, so send an email to me at Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. Again, that's myndtalk.org. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. Take care.